Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Earlier this week, it was announced that scientists believe they have cured a young girl of HIV because the toddler had been treated with high doses of antiretroviral drugs soon after birth. To learn more about how this cure may have worked and what implications it might have for HIV patients around the world, especially young ones, we are joined by Dr. Michael Brady. He is the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at OSU's College of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So is the scientific community convinced that this young girl was actually cured? Is that why when it became news?
So it became news because any time that you put the words HIV and cure in the same sentence, it's going to attract a lot of notoriety. And I think that there are some people that actually believe that this is what they are calling a functional cure. I think that probably most people feel that the kind of possibility exists that this may not be necessarily a cure of an infected infant, but a new approach to try to protect infants who are exposed near term with very strong treatments to do what we would call post-exposure prophylaxis. And I think that in either case, I think it represents a significant advancement in our understanding of how to reduce the impact of HIV infection. But I do believe that there are a number of people who are still not 100% convinced that this represents a cure.
Is it clear to us now that every infant who is exposed to HIV in this way at birth gets it necessarily?
No. So Before we had antiretroviral therapy treatment, the rate of transmission from mother to infant was about 25%. So in reality, the majority of infants who were born to HIV-infected mothers actually didn't become infected. However, there was 25%, and with a large number of women who are infected, that number then resulted in somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,000 infants each year in the United States becoming infected. And then when you get to many of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, et cetera, the numbers are significantly more. So it definitely is not necessarily a guarantee that you're infected. In this particular situation, what happened was the mother did not have prenatal testing and apparently also did not have very good prenatal care. And because of that, she was not identified as being infected until she came to delivery. Now, one of the things that has markedly enhanced our ability to kind of reduce infections has been identification of mothers during pregnancy with the administration then of antiretroviral therapy, which results in a reduction in the mother's viral load, which then results in a reduction in the infant's rate of infection. So in situations where therapies are started on time, we have now rates of transmission that are close to 1% or lower. So that's significantly better than what we had before therapies when the rate of transmission was 25%.
It's interesting in this story about this toddler that her mother took her away for, I think it was 3 or 6 months or something like
right.
that. And so what we learn from that is that it's possibly more about the timing than it is about the amount of the antiretroviral.
I think what we've learned from this is, as I mentioned, this could represent a cure. And by a cure, what people are talking about is that the infant acquired infection, and most of the infection that occurs typically occurs late in pregnancy or at the time of delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you anticipate happens is that the virus enters into the infant's cells. It multiplies. When it multiplies, it actually then kills the cell that it's multiplying in, and then gets released into the bloodstream and goes finds additional cells to infect. And that happens over and over again. And eventually, the cells that are killed, which are some of them are very important to our immune system, et cetera, result then in the changes that we saw with people back in the 1980s and early 1990s before we had significant therapies, and went on to develop HIV-related AIDS complications. Well, in this situation, it's entirely possible that what happened was that the infant had been infected very late in the pregnancy and had only a few opportunities for the virus to multiply with inside the infant, and that by the very rapid administration of what would be considered a, you know, kind of an aggressive therapeutic approach, it may have resulted in the infant having the virus kind of stopped before it entered into what are called the reservoirs. So there are actually, the reason that we can't eliminate HIV infection from people, even those that are given good therapies now, is that there typically are cells that live a very long period of time that can become infected. And when they become infected, if you stop taking treatment, the virus then has the opportunity to return and result in disease. Well, in this particular case, what is hypothesized is that either they got to the baby before those reservoir cells were infected, or that there were so few that they were able to kind of eliminate the virus. And, you know, I hope that that's maybe what happened, but I think an equally reasonable situation is that the mother, who had not received any medicines, had high amounts of virus in her bloodstream and also had infected cells. And we do know that there is transfer of mother's cells as well as virus to the baby, and that they may have actually started the medication in the infant before the infant actually was infected. And this would be very consistent with what we call post-exposure prophylaxis. And we will use this in situations, it first was used in healthcare workers who were getting exposed during their occupational situation. More recently, it's been identified as a reasonable approach to try to reduce situations after sexual activity, particularly after rapes, et cetera, but also it's used now in situations that just with people found out that they got exposed to somebody who was infected and they go for post-exposure prophylaxis. So I think that even if that's the case, it's still valuable because we still have, I mentioned we were not down to 0% transmission, that we do have women who, like this mother, present either with a high viral load, either because they've not received any prenatal care or because their therapy either was not, they were not compliant or was ineffective because of viral resistance. If that's the case, this may give us an opportunity to protect those children by using very early aggressive treatment. So I think this is a tremendous advancement, but it may not be exactly the way, it may be slightly different than it's been portrayed.
Only about 3 adults have ever been cured of HIV, according to an article I read. But their cases are so rare that doctors can't use the same techniques to cure others.
Well, what happened is I think the only one that people feel 100% that there was a cure was an individual who received a stem cell transplant. And in, under those circumstances, the individual had another reason that they needed to get the stem cell transplant. They had leukemia. And as part of the process to get the person ready for the bone marrow transplant, they would then have significant therapies that are designed to eliminate the immune cells, because when they get somebody else's stem cells, they don't want them to react to them.
Right.
Well, that happens to be the reservoir cells for HIV. So that therapy then created an opportunity to eliminate the reservoir cells. And then when the person was reconstituted with a stem cell marrow that came from somebody who wasn't HIV infected, now what happens is you've got a repopulated immune system that doesn't include cells that are infected with HIV. So that, I think, is the situation where people kind of feel very comfortable that there's a cure. Now, in previous times, there have been a few people that people have suggested may be cured, but they were done at a time when the technology was probably not adequate for us to be able to kind of establish whether the person was or was not infected at the time they made that claim. So I think that the one individual with the stem cell transplant is probably the only one that people are very comfortable probably represents a cure. And the problem with that is that stem cell transplants, they carry with them quite a few risks. And again, since the individual had leukemia, I think it was a reasonable kind of risk to take, because otherwise he would have died from the leukemia. But otherwise, it's probably not an optimal approach, and clearly is a very kind of expensive approach.
When something like this happens, as in the case of the little girl who apparently has been cured,
right.
Do you, where you sit as chair of the Department of Pediatrics at OSU's College of Medicine, start to hear a lot of chatter out there? Are physicians that you talk to, pediatricians, getting a lot of questions from patients and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple things. So first of all, this made a lot of splash in the news.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question that people are talking about it. I went to a meeting on campus on Monday, shortly after this came out, and a number of people kind of asked me some questions about it that aren't necessarily even involved with HIV, but it's something that, is clearly a topical situation. So I think that there's no question that's the case. The next situation is going to be trying to see how patients are going to potentially respond to this, because, since we have good therapies but no cures, they still kind of have to live with taking lots of medications, et cetera. So it's very clear that we are probably going to hear from patients who would like to understand whether or not this is something that they might benefit from. And I think that we probably will be able to use this information to be able to change how we kind of address things. And again, as I mentioned, right now, I think that if we have women who come to delivery and are either detected at delivery as being infected or have high viral loads that were not able to be reduced by a number of different reasons, this may influence the new guidelines that might come out about how to manage those children more aggressively to try to see if we can't protect that baby from becoming infected.
Dr. Michael Brady, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate
sure.
it. Dr. Michael Brady is the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at OSU's College of Medicine. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about HIV/AIDS as it relates to women and girls. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Lynn Neary. Every day brings fresh news developments and interesting stories to tell. At Talk of the Nation, we look for the stories that matter to you. From international news to the latest campaign politics to the issues that touch your family. Tune in for the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees in downtown Columbus, a slight chance of snow, cloudy skies, a high of 35 today. Clouds tonight and a low of 20 degrees. Support comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Though the world received some positive news about HIV and AIDS this week, it remains a very, both HIV and AIDS remain very serious dangers. 34 million people worldwide are infected, and a growing number of women of color and girls are at greater risk. March 10th marks National Women and Girls HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. In Columbus, a girls' revelation and empowerment workshop is scheduled for March 9th. You can check out our website at WOSU.org/allsides for a link to the Ohio AIDS Coalition's website to learn more about that. Joining us now to discuss the particular risks women and girls face when it comes to HIV is Jean Tidd. She's the clinical supervisor for the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you. Good morning.
What is the trends of HIV infection for women? The trajectory, are things getting better? Do they keep go up and down? Does it depend on the time of year?
Well, I think unfortunately, we have not seen the decrease in infection rates among women that we would have liked to have seen by now. Currently, 24% of all HIV diagnoses are accountable to women, and that gives us 280,000 women living with HIV and AIDS in the United States. Women of color are particularly affected, accounting for two-thirds or 64% of new AIDS diagnoses at this point in time.
How do you explain this lack of achievement in reducing that number?
Well, I think a couple issues become pretty clear. First and foremost, who is vulnerable to HIV and AIDS is still cloaked in some kind of mystery for the majority of people day to day. Women are still not receiving the kind of education, the kind of message that would lead them to think that they may, in fact, be somebody who may be HIV positive. And it's much like research and efforts for women and other healthcare issues. I know we've seen things happen with heart disease in women and the different kinds of marketing. Much of it's similar for women in HIV and AIDS. The symptoms are even different for men than for women.
What's the girls' part of it?
Well, we know that girls are becoming sexually active much younger, and boys as well. And it's an attempt to try to increase awareness and begin awareness as early as possible. One of the things that Dr. Brady pointed out a few moments ago is that the sooner women are tested and are aware of their status, the sooner they're able to start treatment and potentially impact any decisions they may have to become pregnant and have children. And I don't think we can start too soon increasing the awareness for young girls in hopes that they may be able to make different decisions as they grow into being women.
My guest, if you want to give us a call and talk about this, Jean Tidd. She's Client Services Supervisor at the AIDS Resource Center in Ohio. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about about women and girls in regards to HIV/AIDS, the Awareness Day, National Awareness Day of for women and girls HIV/AIDS is March 10th. And on March 9th, there is a program scheduled. It's called A Girl's Revelation and Empowerment Workshop. If you want more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And go to the link there. You can give us a call now, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We welcome any questions or comments. Is the reason that the outreach, is it more a factor of gender as you compared it to heart disease? Or does it have something to do with, pardon me, vestiges of the stigmas regarding AIDS?
I think both of those factors can't be ignored. There is still so much stigma attached to becoming HIV positive, and then more specifically for women, women are given such a mixed message about sexuality and sexual health anyway. So when you combine those two factors, women simply either don't have access to the right kinds of information. Sometimes they aren't even being asked by their medical providers if they would even be at risk. I think that's perhaps one of the biggest differences that medical providers can have in terms of impacting the numbers of women who become HIV positive. The bottom line is any woman who potentially has unprotected sex with any person who could be HIV positive, any man who could be HIV positive, is at risk. Doesn't matter.
But if she doesn't know the man is HIV positive or could be.
Right. And
maybe
that,
it's her husband.
Correct. Correct. And we have seen, unfortunately, we have had all kinds of stories come our way about how women have become infected. And having a conversation, again, I think this speaks to how we educate girls and women with regard to sexuality, with regard to self-esteem. And women don't necessarily have the skills or the courage to have the discussions about their current partner's sexual history. And oftentimes, women find out that they've even been exposed to HIV and AIDS accidentally.
Meaning,
sometimes their husband may suddenly turn up very, very ill. Or we've had a situation where an old partner died, and information then came that the person had died of HIV, and the woman waited a great period of time before she actually had the courage to go be tested. And when she did test, she also was infected and had become pretty ill as well. So I think going back to why reaching out to girls, it's the conversation. It's empowering girls about their health, their well-being, their rights in relationships, and then trying to do so with adult women as well.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jean Tidd of AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. New HIV infections dropped 21% in Black women in 2010. That's very good news. That's huge. What do you think do you attribute that to?
Well, I do think that prevention efforts and outreach efforts of not only AIDS service organizations, but other kinds of women's health organizations are putting more energy and effort towards making sure that women are informed and empowered and have access to testing and treatment. However, the statistics still speak to 1 out of 32 African-American women can be expected to be diagnosed as HIV positive in their lifetime, and 1 out of 526 Caucasian or Asian women can expect to be.
All right. So what's the big difference there? Why the disparity, I guess. I'm not sure what the right word is right off the end.
Well, I think both words
are
appropriate in this situation. This is a tough topic as well, because it's there's multi aspects to it. So much of it goes back again to how we view sexuality, and there are some cultural differences in how sexuality is approached, and particularly with men who may have in fact become HIV positive through having sex with other men, and then whether or not they're able to reveal that information or they feel comfortable able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece is with regard to health disparities and care, treatment, ongoing gynecological exams, follow-up. Economics plays a part of this, socioeconomic status, the reality of racism and health disparity. I mean, there are so many factors that contribute. And that's why I think it makes it challenging, because it's not a one-shot solution. There are so many different players and so many different aspects of these issues that would need to be addressed. And progress is being made. However, again, like I'd mentioned before, healthcare, access to healthcare, research, information just comes slower with regard to women, unfortunately.
You know, the media has been talking about the African-American community's response to the issue of AIDS and HIV for a long time. And a lot of people are frustrated that there hasn't been more headway in educating. And a lot of people think, well, it should come from the pulpit, it should come from the schools. What is being done? Is there anything concrete that the AIDS Resource Center Ohio is doing to address that?
Yes, actually, progress has been made in that area. For example, the outreach effort that we have taking place for women and girls HIV awareness is actually taking place at a predominantly African-American church. And we have seen more and more involvement and partnering between ARC Ohio and many of the predominantly African-American churches locally. Again, you know, they're in a position of slow and steady wins the race. It's not an easy discussion, and it's we're getting there. Slow steps.
Rose in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Rose.
Hi. I'd like to know if a woman is having sex with only female partners, are she at risk of getting HIV too?
Can women affect each other?
Well,
infect each other.
I think that's a really good question, and What you want to keep in mind is that women's transmission of HIV to other women is much lower of a risk, probably the lowest risk. But if any kinds of sexual toys are being used, you want to make sure that condoms are being used on those toys and that you're still taking universal precautions to keep you and your partner safe.
Does that help? Does that help, Rose?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for a call. Good question. We have a few more minutes left with Jean Tidd of the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio, 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can go to our website. You can go to our Facebook page, post there, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, let's get to the teenager thing, because I'm sure that's just a tough time in general. And and this is a girls' revelation and empowerment workshop, which I mean, that means under 18, right?
Yes.
So what are you going to do there?
Well, I think probably what will be most important is just beginning to develop some relationship with the girls. You can imagine the awkwardness at such a gathering.
I mean, is it girls who are already infected that are going to be going, or?
No, not necessarily.
So you don't know who's going to show up.
Correct. Right. And the relationship will be primary, setting the tone so that the girls who do attend are even able to hear a message. And I think that message will not just address sexual activity. Sometimes so much of our efforts with kids and with adults goes right to the actual sexual activity, when in fact so much about making good and positive decisions for yourself really start with your communication skills and really understanding what you do and don't have a right to expect out of someone else, and how to find the words to be able to ask for what you need and ask for what you want. So I think that groundwork being in place then makes more sexual discussions easier for young women to hear and potentially to be more effective. We can teach condom use and safe sex 24 hours a day, but if we don't teach humans, people, to communicate with each other, to actually be able to have a conversation or to be able to say no to someone about anything, then we're missing the boat and actually trying to empower girls and women to take care of themselves.
Are you kind of hoping they'll come with friends?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the good thing you can count on with young girls oftentimes. Where there's one, there's four or five other young souls. So hopefully
so. Know.
Yeah.
IV drug use, long time contributor to the problem. Where are we going with that?
Well, IV drug use, especially if you pay attention to the news and information locally, specifically with heroin use.
Mm-hmm. It's bigger than prescription drugs
yes.
now.
Yes. And so we are still we are still seeing just as much exposure. Again, this is an educational effort to help people understand the importance of clean needles. We don't have any local needle exchange.
Is that against the law in Ohio?
Yes. And it's a risk reduction conversation that our prevention and outreach folks do, and also the case managers and social workers. But it's a real reality. If you are high on heroin, it's a challenge to get yourself to think about clean needles. It's much easier for you to commit to clean needles when you're not high, but in that moment, it's a more difficult discussion. But we continue to try to make people aware and discuss with them the best ways that they could potentially avoid transmission that way.
Mimi and Hilliard, welcome to the show.
Hi. I've heard a lot of talk about education and, that sort of thing to help with prevention. But the one thing that I have not heard discussed is teaching self-esteem and the worth of oneself and one's dignity, teaching girls that sex is not what you are about, that celibacy is an option, and abstaining from these things, you know, if you value yourself and you have respect for yourself, that alone, I think if we were teaching more of that, we might be able to save a lot of girls.
I don't know if the word celibacy comes up or not in the awareness day, but what about that issue? It's like you don't have to have sex.
Right.
Does that come up?
Mimi, you're absolutely correct. And I'm sorry if I didn't make that a little bit clearer a second ago when I said the efforts with the younger girls are not focused on the actual act of sex, but more so on decision making and empowering oneself and even understanding that you have the right to the expectation to remain abstinent or have more control over what you decide to do with your body. But you are absolutely correct about that. On the other hand, we still also have to make sure that we are educating for the reality, which is hopefully kids will make the kinds of decisions we want them to, and they will do things that are healthier. And let's also prepare them in case they decide they are ready for some kind of sexual activity and they are prepared to be able to protect themselves. It's a balance, and I know it's a careful balance and a tough balance, but I do feel strongly that we can achieve that balance in our education efforts.
Thank you, Mimi, for that question. We appreciate it. And thanks to Jean Tidd. I appreciate you being here today.
Great. Thank you.
Jean Tidd is Client Services Supervisor at the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. Once again, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides for a link to learn more about the Girls Revelation and Empowerment Workshop scheduled for this weekend. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Nobody expected Mike Piazza to make it in the big leagues, but he became a 12-time All-Star. On the next Fresh Air, Piazza talks about his life in the game, being inaccurately outed as gay, and getting a clubhouse call from Roger Clemens after the pitcher beamed him.
I was not in the mood to talk, so I basically told him where to put the phone.
Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And tonight, the tenors visit the WOSU-TV studios to discuss their dazzling new show. Enjoy music from their newly released album, Lead With Your Heart. Each act of the show stretches the boundaries of classical crossover by combining classic songs, modern tunes, and world music. From cover features of Bob Dylan's Forever Young to the inspirational anthem Amazing Grace, watch the tenors lead with your heart. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. And it's 35 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect cloudy skies for today, maybe some light snow flurries, and steady temperatures right around 35. Clouds for tonight and cold, a low of 20 degrees. Sunshine with a high near 40 on Friday, and sunny with a high near 50 for Saturday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Nowhere on earth has HIV/AIDS been more devastating than in sub-Saharan Africa. Sadly, the results of a recent clinical trial of women in Africa seems to show that daily preventative treatments had no effect on preventing HIV infection. Joining us by phone from Seattle to discuss the NIH-funded trial is Dr. Jeannie Marazzo, who teaches medicine at the University of Washington and was one of the leaders of the trial. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anne. It's great to be here.
So the trial tested three preventative measures against infection. What were they?
So two of them are pills that are routinely used to treat HIV in people who are already infected, and those include drugs called tenofovir and Truvada. And then the third method was a relatively novel intervention called a tenofovir vaginal gel. The same drug that actually is in the tenofovir pill, but it's formulated in a gel to be used intravaginally. And we asked women to use each of these products once daily.
And how did they work? Do you have varying degrees of success?
Well, sadly, the main issue with the study was that women essentially rejected daily use of the product. We measured whether women were using the products every day. We asked women, you know, through several methods whether they were using the product. We even measured the pills that they brought back or the applicators that they brought back for the gel. And throughout the study, it appeared they were using it. However, at the very end of the study, we actually measured the drug levels in their blood to confirm essentially what they had been telling us. And there was a very big disconnect. In fact, that's probably one of the three main findings of the study, that despite the fact that it appeared women were really using these products on a daily basis throughout based on what they were telling us, we really only found evidence of use in about 30% of the expected visits. So we really think that the products didn't work because women just did not find it acceptable to use them on a consistent basis, i.e. daily.
Now, we're talking about taking a pill or using a gel.
Right.
In private.
That's right.
What do we know about their objection to it? Because maybe, I guess, that's where the studies have to start?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think we need to pause and take a step back and recognize that what we have been calling quote-unquote biomedical interventions, i.e. medicines or vaccines or circumcision, are as much behavioral as they are medical. So we're asking people to do something every day that they may not find themselves able to do. We've had a number of interviews with subjects and also with people in the community. And of course, given these results, we're going to go back even more intensively and try to get to the bottom of this. And some of the messages that have come across have included things like the stigma around having HIV in these communities is so intense that even having a drug that looks like an HIV drug in your house, in your purse, your sister might see it, your mother might see it, your partner, your boyfriend, your husband might see it, that could induce a lot of problems for people. And so really, it's a probably a very complex background that relates to women's challenges to protect themselves from HIV, even if they don't already have it.
So there's the stigma, but they did show up to get the medication. Mm-hmm. The problem was they weren't taking it.
Yes, and you really hit on the million-dollar question. We actually kept women in the study to a degree that was fantastic. I mean, it was one of the reasons people are so interested in the study is because it was so beautifully done by the local team.
And by the way, over 5,000 women.
Over 5,000 women, 5,029 to mm-hmm. be exact, actually. And we retained, which is the word we use, we actually kept over 90% of the women in the study. We had women come back for 95% of their expected follow-up. So it was really great. Why did women come back? Because I personally think, I mean, and what we've heard and what we're gathering to really confirm this, is that they loved the care. They loved getting contraception. They loved counseling. They loved getting monthly HIV tests. They loved getting the STD or sexually transmitted disease screening. We provided pap smears, which women do not routinely get in most of these settings. And we treated any infections that we found. And also, it was a social framework. The waiting rooms were, you know, full of participants, and the staff were fantastic. So to me, women voted for care and structure and really told us what they need, what it did not appear that they knew they needed, despite very high rates of HIV in the study, which I haven't even mentioned, mm-hmm. was the HIV prevention medications.
My guest is Dr. Jeannie Morazzo, a professor of medicine at the University of Washington. If you have a question or comment for her regarding this trial in sub-Saharan Africa of 5,029 sexually active women, it was a daily use HIV prevention approach, and it proved ineffective. That's what we're talking about. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a quick call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Talk about the rate of infection then.
Right. So, and when we planned this study, we anticipated that we would see an HIV incidence of around 4. And for people who don't know what incidence is, that just gives you a number per 100 women you would expect to see in a year. So a 4% incidence means if you saw 100 women in the study, 4 over the course of a year would get infected. And we needed that to figure out how many women to enroll, basically. Mm-hmm. Instead, we saw an overall incidence rate of 5.7, so very, very high. And more disturbingly, or equally disturbingly, we saw rates of up to 10% in young unmarried women in South Africa. In South African women who were over 25 years who were unmarried, we saw a rate of 7%. And even in Uganda and Zimbabwe, which have a reputation for having, you know, relatively controlled HIV infection, certainly relative to South Africa, in young unmarried women, we saw incidences of about 3%. To give you some perspective, in the United States, the only place that you would see an incidence of 5 to 6% is in young gay men in some metropolitan centers, and often young African-American gay men. So we see very, very little of incidences like that. And I think it was stunning to some people because many people are talking about treatment as prevention, turning the tide of the HIV epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa. We're treating more people with HIV. We're hopefully making them less infectious. But clearly the women in our study have not benefited yet from those excellent interventions.
That particular young unmarried women demographic mm-hmm. has been studied. There's a definite socioeconomic issue going on. A lot of them are getting it from older men.
That is probably true.
Who are taking care of them and feeding them and giving them clothes.
Certainly anecdotally, mm-hmm. that has been reported. I would emphasize, though, mm-hmm. that it's you have to be cautious to generalize in a study like this. So, for example, in Zimbabwe, most of the women in the study were married, and those who were married those who were older and those who reported a partner who was older than 28 were the most likely to take their study drugs. So, you know, you need to sort of look at differences in where people live, urban, rural. If you live in downtown Durban, which is a huge migratory center, people move in and out of there all the time, it's different than if you live in Harare or Kampala or a rural area like some of the Durban sites. So, yes, those are definitely real patterns that you mentioned. But, you know, every woman's story is probably different to some extent.
Matthew in Whitehall, you're on the air. Welcome, Matthew.
Hello. I just had a question for your guest, and I was kind of wondering, with the sub-Saharan trial that you had done, I just was wondering, how was it basically so that you kept the participants from, say, signing up for this to in order to give the medication to maybe, say, a friend or a family member who is infected with HIV?
I think that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're sharing it with someone who needs it more.
Maybe that's why they weren't taking the medication themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have to put yourself in these women's place. When you're in an area that's experiencing this much HIV, you are going to see people around you being sick. You're going to see babies who are getting infected. You're going to see your friends get infected. So I think that, as always, there are pressures on women to make it okay for the people around them, right? Women tend to be caretakers. We are exploring in depth the degree of product sharing. We actually asked that during the study because we had heard from our social science colleagues and from anthropologists that this almost certainly happens in many of these settings for the reasons I mentioned. Women did not share that they were doing that with us during the study, but I think when we go back and try to talk to them with more, you know, being more straightforward and saying, look, you know, we know people weren't taking the drug. What happened to the study product? So I think that that's an excellent possibility. We certainly counseled people very intensively about the dangers of doing that, that these are very strong medications, that we were monitoring the participants very carefully for any problems with them. And we obviously couldn't do that if they just gave them to people that we didn't even know about. Thanks for that question.
Yeah, very good question, Matthew. Thank you. Let me ask you about kind of, I guess, the prophylactic nature of this. When we talk about preventative, is that what we're talking about? So when you're talking about the gel, is it something you use just before you're having sex?
So great question. Yes, this is a strategy called PrEP, and maybe you've heard that. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. I'll give you another example of PrEP. When you go to travel to a foreign country and you take malaria pills, that's an example of pre-exposure prophylaxis. You're loading your body up with a drug that will fight off the ability of the invading pathogen, whether it's malaria or HIV, to establish an infection. So the idea here is to really give people who are not already infected the potential to have the capacity to fight off the virus before it establishes infection. Okay, the gel has been studied, as you mentioned, in the pattern of before and after sex. We did not do that. We asked women to use it on a daily basis.
Okay.
So that's a critical distinction.
Well, then why then, when it comes to the gel and the pills, didn't you just have them take it in front of you?
Yeah, very good question. So some people have absolutely advocated for directly observed therapy. And that is a strategy that's used, for example, to treat tuberculosis in people in whom we're very concerned about their potential to transmit TB. So you'll have them come into the clinic usually twice a week. If you have a drug, you can administer that infrequently, and you'll actually watch them put the pill in their mouth. The issue here, of course, is practicality and capacity. Many of these women have pretty busy lives. Many of them live out of the setting where the clinic is. In fact, for some, it was quite an effort to come to the clinic, which is another remarkable thing about our ability to keep women in. So it really would not be practical. It also wouldn't be practical in terms of the staff. You know, when you think about the logistics of having a study that had 5,020 women whom you were seeing every single month, you know, we were really stretched to our capacity to even do the scheduled visits, let alone directly observe therapy. But that is something I think that should enter the conversation as we move forward. I will say, to carry, to just sort of take that comment to the next step,
mm-hmm.
that I think one of the more exciting areas moving forward is to think about methods of delivering drugs that we know should prevent against HIV in ways that don't require daily adherence. And the two things that people are very excited about are vaginal rings, like the there's a vaginal contraceptive ring, but now there's a ring under study in very similar populations that basically releases an HIV drug and you can keep it in for a month. The other thing that we heard about at the conference this week are injections that would be like a progesterone contraceptive injection, but it would be PrEP and you would have a shot every month that would release drugs that would protect you. So those are exciting areas, but we still have to know what women want.
Right.
And I think that we can't lose sight of that, and this study really emphasizes that.
This, I don't know how expensive this study was. How expensive are the drugs? Is something going forward that their government or they are going to be able to afford anyway?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So, you know, the whole availability and affordability of antiretroviral drugs, even for people with HIV, is still a challenge. Thanks to PEPFAR, many more people have been treated in this part of the world than I think would ever have happened. But, for example, the government of South Africa has really stepped up and has very ambitious goals to treat everybody who needs it within the next coming years. For something like PrEP, you know, if we had demonstrated that these products worked in this population, then it really would have been, I think, a conversation about how the drugs would have been paid for and how you would get them to the people who need them at most. You know, even in this study, we treated a lot of women or tried to treat a lot of women who ultimately didn't get HIV. So I think trying to hone in on who needs it most, whether because their partner's infected or because they are in a certain demographic, a certain neighborhood, that would be the way to do it.
And there are follow-up studies going on right now.
There are follow-up studies going on now. In fact, I should mention that part of the reason people were surprised about our results is that there have been several studies showing that this strategy works, particularly for the pills. One of the studies that showed the best success with oral PrEP or Truvada, tenofovir tablets, was a study done by colleagues of mine at the University of Washington here. They did it in Kenya and Uganda, and they enrolled couples in whom one partner was infected and the other wasn't. And they actually randomized or randomly assigned the uninfected partner to PrEP or no PrEP, so Truvada, tenofovir, or a placebo. And when they did that, they showed that the strategy reduced the risk of HIV infection in the uninfected person by, on average, 70 to 80%.
Wow.
So that says to me that when you approach this as a relationship, you know, you enroll both couples, mm-hmm. the partner's supportive. That's a very different thing than asking these young women who may not have the support of their partners or their families to do this. So I think it's very context specific, and you have to think carefully about how best to implement something that I think works as a scientific intervention. Mm-hmm. It's just as a social intervention, we really have to do some work.
Dr. Jeannie Marazzo, thank you so much for joining us today. It's very interesting.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck in your research.
Dr.
Jeannie Marazzo is a professor of medicine at the University of Washington. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.